This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Kentucky Main Street Conference is being held for its 40th year this week in Covington. Coming up, we'll talk with the Main Street managers in Bellevue and Covington about how they're keeping momentum alive in their cities. Plus, a conversation with the University of Cincinnati student who's collected tens of thousands of pieces of denim. But first, a change is coming to the leadership at the Cincinnati Nature Center. On this Earth Day, we'll talk about that and the effort to create a greener, cleaner, and more sustainable environment. Joining Cincinnati Edition in the studio is Nature Center Executive Director Bill Hoppel. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day to you. And the Executive Director of the Wilderness Center in Wilmot, Ohio, is Dr. Jeffrey Corney. He joins us on the phone. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi.
And Jeff is going to replace Bill as the executive director of the Cincinnati Nature Center. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. If you have questions or comments about this segment, give us a call, 513-419-7100. Also email talk at wvxu.org or find some comments on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for those as well. Bill, you've been with the Nature Center more than two decades. When did you reach the decision that it was time to step away?
Oh, I think a year or two ago, I just sort of did the math, and my wife had sold her store a couple years ago and decided it was time to pass the baton for both for me and for the center.
And time for both of you to start staying home, I guess.
And play a little bit more.
All right, cool. And Jeff, you're poised to take over. Tell us about what you see in this opportunity.
Oh, well, some tremendous opportunity. The Cincinnati Nature Center has always been sort of an aspirational center. During my career, I've been a director for 17 years at three different facilities, and I've often looked to Cincinnati as sort of a gold standard. So when the opportunity came to take over leadership, especially from someone like Bill, who's run it so well, I just couldn't pass that up.
Well, Jeff, tell us why you looked at the Cincinnati Nature Center as the gold standard.
Well, for one, it's one of the largest in the country, and I would say one of the best run. The center I run now here at the Wilderness Center, we have a similar origin story in the mid-60s, kind of during those early environmental movements that led to the first Earth Day. And so we kind of grew up in the same sort of philosophy. The Cincinnati Nature Center, I think, has an advantage of being a little closer to an urban center than this place, but we do a lot of the same things, a lot of the same scope, just a little different scale. And Cincy has grown to such a level that I think it has a tremendous influence, especially in sort of our modern time, if you will, with these environmental issues. And that's important.
Bill, talk about that. Talk about how the Nature Center here in Cincinnati has managed to grow to have the kind of influence that Jeff says it does.
Well, we were fortunate at our start in the mid-60s to be founded by a group of very well-connected and passionate leaders. And when I came in 96, it was just a matter of taking what we had, blessed with a large piece, two large pieces of property. And then in the things grew. I think a couple of things led to our growth in the last 10 years, not the least of which was our realization that we needed to be much more intentional about connecting people to the natural world. And there were a number of factors, but the one key one was the creation of our Nature Playscape, which was opened in 2011. Now attracts 35,000 to 40,000 adults and children every year. We've realized that we have to be much more intentional today. Population has grown, denser urban areas, and kids are just not walking out the back door and playing in the woods. So we have to be much more intentional. And I think that intentionality by both Cincinnati Nature Center and many, many others has fortunately, the public's responded and it's led to our significant growth. There have been a number of other factors, but that was a key one.
Talk about your facilities that you have.
Well, first, we have close to 1,800 acres on two properties. Roe Woods, which opened in 1967 to the public, is now a little over 1,000 acres. And in the early 70s, we were blessed with a donation of Long Branch Farm out in the Goshen Township area. It now has close to 800 acres. The heart of our operation is Roe Woods with 15, 16 miles of trails, visitor center, preschool, playscape, and now, as of 2 years ago, our new regional conservation center for conservation. Long Branch has 6 miles of trails open to members. We run programs, summer camps, and do a lot of conservation on the fields out there. We have a new native plant nursery at Long Branch. So there's a quick snapshot. I could go on.
We'll let you go on in a moment.
We're blessed.
Awesome. Jeff, Wilmot, where you are currently, that's closer to Cleveland. For those of us who are unfamiliar or haven't been to your establishment where you are currently, tell us what the Wilderness Center is.
Right. Well, the Wilderness Center, we're actually about 45 minutes south of Cleveland, but we sort of serve the northeast sector of Ohio. We're close to Madison, Canton, Akron area. So we're a little more rural located, which means that, kind of as Bill was saying, we're kind of adapting to sort of a new generation. One of the issues we face is, you know, it's both the boom and the bang. We're in a beautiful rural location, sort of an Amish country. Wonderful. But these days, folks don't care to make that 30 to 40 minute trip. So we're trying to find creative ways to get folks here. We have 650 acres at this headquarters property and own another 1,500 acres throughout Northeast Ohio. And our main facility offers about 8 miles worth of trails. We too have a playscape, albeit a bit smaller than Cincy's. We also have a green burial site and offer consulting forestry. So we do quite a bit of conservation sort of beyond the footprint of our nature center to kind of reach those audiences that don't necessarily make the trip to a site, but we want to have an influence on, you know, how they too connect with nature.
Okay, guys, we're here today to talk about nature on Earth Day. The first Earth Day was officially proclaimed in 1970. So I want to ask you both, and Bill, we'll start with you. Do you think we Earthlings are treating the planet with more seriousness now than we were 50 years ago?
Yes and no. Seriousness, I think there's a greater awareness of our impact on the planet. Today, obviously, there's some disagreement on just what that impact is. So seriousness, yes, but we have a huge challenge ahead of us. When Earth Day was founded in the 70s, it was really an educational focus, and that continues today. But I think the focus today now is on getting people to take action relative to climate change.
And Jeff, I'd like your thoughts on that as well.
I think not only a greater awareness, something I've realized, I teach environmental studies over at the College of Worcester, so I get to interact with a number of young 20-somethings, sort of arguably the next generation will hopefully solve some of these problems. And a shift that I've seen is a greater awareness, but also a greater sense of systems thinking, sort of looking at things in a more connected way, that what impacts we Earthlings are having on the planet. I think in the early stages of environmental thought, 60s, 70s, it was usually a single point issue, acid rain, ozone, burning Cuyahoga, that sort of thing. And that now, seeing that these individual events are connected to a bigger Earth system, if you will, you pull one thread, you necessarily affect another. And I guess I find that somewhat encouraging, because I think in there is part of the solution, is looking at the entire Earth system and knowing that we're having an impact, not just on a regional area, but globally as well.
Morning Edition today on NPR reported this morning about a poll that showed an overwhelming majority of parents want their kids to learn about climate change at school. Also on Sunday, the website Vox reported, quote, "Kids today face a truly frightening climate future, and they're mad as hell at adults for neglecting the problem. Many people under the age of 18 right now may be around to see the end of the century, and a growing number of them are not pleased with the climate that they're inheriting." So I want to ask you guys, is there a right way to talk to kids about the impact that climate is having on our natural environment, Bill?
I think you start by talking about your local environment. They need to understand and appreciate the world they're living in here. Yes, they need to connect it to the global sphere, but we got to get people outside locally to first appreciate and understand. And so whether that's through our schools program, the playscape, all of the organizations here locally, the parks are all doing the same thing. It starts by having them understand and appreciate. And as I say, we need to be more intentional about that today than we did 30 years ago. It's actually safer today for children to play outside. but parents perceive it as not as safe because of the change in the media. Everything is in the media immediately, when in fact it's not as much of a concern.
Are there some examples locally that you would highlight to kids to say this is what's changing due to adverse conditions in the climate?
The first is to point at the habitat and that the invasive species that today are a much more greater awareness that we have. Everybody's talked about honeysuckle and the understory and the impact of that on the forest. Our biggest concern today is a little tiny, beautiful yellow buttercup that is actually out right now called lesser celandine, and it has just skyrocketed. And I think people look at it and see, oh, that's beautiful. Can I take some and put some in my garden? What they don't realize is that it's going to take over their garden. And as a result, we're seeing a decrease in the diversity of the plants that are living in the forest. And the forest is not as healthy as it was because of these invasives. So starting local, getting people to understand what's native, what's not native. And that also ties into, on a longer term perspective, native plants are where we want to be in terms of combating, if you will, climate change, because they're going to succeed and survive much better than your imported plants.
And Jeff, at the Wilderness Center, where you currently are before your arrival to take over at the Cincinnati Nature Center, what experience do you have in terms of teaching kids about the effects of climate change?
Right. Well, for one thing, I like the term intentionality. We sort of intentionally target, kind of pride ourselves in what we call full life cycle or full spectrum teaching, from, you know, basically pre-K, K through elementary school, through high school. I'm teaching at college level and adult programs to kind of hit folks kind of at what stage they're at, and begin with that sort of appreciation of nature. We have quite a number of nature hikes, and we too emphasize invasive species and even talk about certain subtle changes in the landscape here. About two-thirds of the landscape of the Wilderness Center was once cropland before it was handed over to the Wilderness Center in the mid-60s. We have aerial photos of that, so we tend to emphasize sort of that change over time in a positive way, that it's going back to natural, but also that it's not what it once was in terms of climate, and that you can kind of see those changes in particular vernal ponds where you might see amphibians, or we can compare numbers from now from a couple decades ago. So get them to both appreciate sort of the fun part of nature, the frogs, the salamanders. But as we go up in the age groups, we're beginning to get a little bit more sophisticated with the science and pointing out, okay, here's some data that was taken 30 years ago from this site. Here's what it is now. You've investigated yourself and do some comparison and kind of let them discover some of that change, so to speak, and then tie it to kind of the bigger issue of, well, why is that? And we can often tie it to, well, a drier condition or some kind of land use change, if you will.
We saw this year that more than 120 countries, kids in those countries, went on strike from school to demand action on climate change. There are projections that our current trajectory puts the planet on course to warm by 4 degrees by 2100. So when you have these kids visiting either the Nature Center or the Wilderness Center, and you're teaching them, whether they're younger or they're older and handling more sophisticated data, as Jeff pointed out, do you find that, Bill, they're eager to engage in this? This is something that they are concerned about and want to take action on?
Very much so. But you said it at the outset, it's really age appropriate. So if you're working with a first grader, it's all about the experience of that child being out in the natural world. If you're talking about a senior in high school, it's more about the science and the concepts. And I would say, yes, they're hungry for not only the experience, but also for the knowledge. And so we need to be very, very specific about getting them that information.
And Jeff, is that something that's changed over the years recently, now that climate change and climate science has dominated media coverage for so many years? Are the visits to your establishments where you've worked different than before, where maybe kids before wanted to come see some animals or see some types of plants, and now they want to engage in this conversation?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'll agree with Bill that, you know, that it's age appropriate. We've been focusing, and I kind of pitch in on the education side, sort of the college and some of the adult programming. And in terms of that hunger, that shift from scientific curiosity to by the time I'm working with my college students, and granted, they're focusing on environmental studies, which is becoming more and more of a true interdisciplinary program at many colleges and universities. College of Worcester, just one of many. I had the same experience at University of Minnesota. I can sense the anger that you mentioned earlier and frustration, but also an eagerness to roll up the sleeves and get to work and say, okay, I'm already. And one of the key changes is, and I've been studying climate change as an issue academically since the early 90s, and a key shift is, as the science gets better and better, though of course there's voices that want to say this is not happening or what have you, that frankly is getting less and less and less. And there's more and more of an acceptance. This is the reality, scientifically the reality. Let's move past that and move towards solution. And that's what I'm hearing from young 20-somethings is enough already. Let's get moving on solutions. Let's see if we can do something about this. After all, we're inheriting this.
Michael, I'd also add that I think there's a major shift that we're much more focused on drawing attention to human impact than we were 20 or 30 years ago. Climate change has brought that in front of us. Obviously, there's still a debate in some sectors, but the question of what is the human impact is a much more part of our language today than it was years ago.
513-419-7100 is the number. We have Christina on the line. Hey, Christina.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing well. How are you?
Good. Just great today on Earth Day.
And what's your question?
Well, I have a comment first. As a longtime member and volunteer at the Cincinnati Nature Center, I just want to say kudos to Bill Hopple. He has done a magnificent job. The programs and the staff at CNC are so professional and forward-thinking, and I'm just proud to have been a part of it. And thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Christina.
And, you're welcome. And then secondly, I did hear Jeff mention something about green burials, which is intriguing. I'm wondering if he'd speak more about that, and is that a possibility at CNC?
All right, Christina, we'll hang up and we'll let Jeff and Bill address that. So just in case you didn't hear, Jeff, Christina wants to know more about something you referenced earlier, and I did get a question about this also in a comment. What is green burial?
Green burial is here at the Wilderness Center. We actually have a subsidiary called Fox Hill Preserve, and it's our green burial cemetery. It's been in business for nearly 10 years. And it's called either green burial or a better term I like now is conservation burial. And what it really means is kind of going back to a more natural way of interment for people where you do not use embalming fluids, you use biodegradable caskets or shrouds, and we've set aside a preserve specifically for this. So we found that it's been extremely popular as both, you know, a community service as well as a tremendous way to conserve land. We found that, you know, cemeteries are sort of a cultural icon, very protected sort of from an ethical point of view as well as legal. It's a very powerful conservation tool, and in part because it engages the community at a very intimate level. So in short, that's green burial.
And Bill, I believe Christina also wanted to know whether this was something that's possible at the Cincinnati Nature Preserve.
Well, I understand there is a group in Cincinnati that has been exploring this. I got a call several years ago. I don't know a lot of detail about it, but I think there is a need in Cincinnati. Whether it's a fit for the Cincinnati Nature Center, I'll leave that to Jeff.
And when does this transition take place?
Jeff starts on May 13th, Monday. We're going to overlap for 2 weeks, and my last day is May 24th.
Well, Bill Hopple, congratulations on your retirement. And Dr. Jeffrey Corney, Jeff, welcome to Cincinnati.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to being there.
Appreciate both of you being here, and we'll look forward to future visits to the Cincinnati Nature Center. Up next, the University of Cincinnati student who started collecting pieces of denim when he was just 9 years old and now has tens of thousands of pieces sent to recycling centers. And later, how Covington and Bellevue are reviving their central business districts. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Eric Hansen first started collecting pieces of denim to be recycled when he was 9 years old in Toledo. Now he's a student at the University of Cincinnati, and over the weekend he hosted another denim drive. Earlier, I spoke with him and Andrea Samber, the founder of Blue Jeans Go Green and the director of Cotton Incorporated. My guests now are Eric Hansen. He's a student at the University of Cincinnati working to collect denim, something he's done for about 10 years. He's collected a lot. We're going to talk about that. We're also joined by Andrea Samber from Cotton Incorporated. Eric, according to the news release the organization sent over, you've collected more than 33,000 pieces of denim for Cotton Incorporated's Blue Jeans Go Green denim recycling program, and you're not finished yet. So tell us what exactly you're doing.
Yeah, so ever since I was nine, I read in my Guinness book or National Geographic magazine, and they were trying to set a Guinness World Record for the largest collection of clothing to be recycled. And the company that they were partnered with was, of course, Blue Jeans Go Green. And that very first year, I collected over 1,700 pairs of denim. And year after year, I really liked working on the project, so I continued doing that. This is my 10th year anniversary working on the project. And basically, I used to live in Toledo, and now I'm a freshman at the University of Cincinnati. But basically, throughout each summer, I would basically have drop boxes and denim drives around the city and then collect all these jeans and then send them to Cotton so that they can turn them into housing insulation. And the housing insulation gets donated to Habitat for Humanity, and it goes up into the bills that they do. So it keeps the denim out of the landfills and goes into a great purpose. So I really love working on the project and working with Blue Jeans Go Green.
Andrea, Eric mentioned that this project keeps denim out of landfills. How big of a problem is jeans in the landfills?
Well, it is. I mean, it's a global problem, textile waste in landfills. And so this is something for the cotton industry that Cotton Incorporated created back in 2006. Since authentic denim is made from cotton, a natural fiber, it can be recycled and used to create something new. As Eric referenced, it becomes natural cotton fiber insulation. But for us, at the forefront of this process is our program, Blue Jeans Go Green. And basically, we have ways to collect denim by working with organizations like the University of Cincinnati and students there like Eric to collect denim for people that no longer want it for whatever reason, but it keeps it out of landfills and we have it turned into something else and then return that back to the community.
Andrea, we heard moments ago that some of this denim is turned into insulation for housing that's constructed by Habitat for Humanity. How did that relationship start?
So back when we started the program in 2006, it had just been after Hurricane Katrina had affected the Gulf Coast region. And as we at Cotton Incorporated were looking for what to do with the denim that we would have turned into insulation, we researched different opportunities and got started with the local Habitat affiliates in the Gulf Coast region, New Orleans and Baton Rouge, as they started to rebuild. And from there, we've been providing over the years to various Habitat for Humanity affiliates across the country. And they've shared with us that it's volunteer-friendly. It does not emit any volatile organic chemicals. It has great resistance to mold and mildew. It has Class A fire ratings. So they're extremely appreciative. Habitat for Humanity affiliates and other building organizations around the U.S. are extremely appreciative to receive this insulation that comes from post-consumer recycled denim across the country.
Andrea, tell us what Cotton Incorporated is.
So Cotton Incorporated is the not-for-profit organization that represents the cotton industry. So we look to build demand for and profitability of cotton. We serve as a pipeline within the industry from the growers in the U.S. All the way up through the pipeline to consumers who purchase cotton and to do research and promotion throughout that pipeline. And so this is Cotton Incorporated's signature consumer sustainability program. It really helps the consumer sort of closed the loop. They've made a responsible purchase by purchasing a natural fiber, and here's a way that, because it's made from cotton, denim can be recycled and then turned into this new product, specifically ultra-touch denim insulation.
So it sounds like what you're saying there with people making responsible decisions and purchasing natural fibers, that there are some pieces of clothing that will end up in the landfill because they can't be used for something else?
There are, but because cotton is a natural and sustainable fiber, it can be recycled. And so specifically denim, that's what the Blue Jeans Go Green program is around denim specifically. And as Eric mentioned, shirts, jackets, skirts, jeans in any condition, that can all be broken down, reprocessed. It's returned to its original cotton fiber state, the hardware, the zippers, the grommets, that's all removed and also recycled. And then the denim is returned to its original natural cotton fiber state and turned into natural cotton fiber insulation, specifically ultra-touch denim insulation.
Eric, take us back to Toledo when you were smaller, and how did these events roll out? How did you manage to get all these people to donate so much denim?
Yeah, so definitely local media coverage definitely helps, but it kind of just became a process year after year. And after you do the project 9 years in a row, the community kind of expects you to keep doing it. So after you kind of get your base through social media and other facets like my website, then people expect and look to denim recycling, which is a big plus for me because that spreads recycling advocacy, the fact that people now want to recycle their denim and are looking for new ways on how to do that. But just year after year, after building up a continuous, base, recycling base, that it definitely helps make the process more streamlined and increases the popularity of denim recycling.
Andrea, what else can denim be recycled for?
So denim can be broken down and recycled. It's used for many different things. The Blue Jeans Go Green program currently only turns it into insulation. To date, through Cotton's Blue Jeans Go Green program and consumers across the U.S., we've collected over 2.4 million pieces of denim, and that's resulted in over 4.5 million square feet of insulation. But there are a variety of other end-use products, but having it turned into insulation gives us the opportunity to give back to the community. We're able to return that insulation to organizations like Habitat for Humanity and other civic-oriented buildings and building organizations, and oftentimes in areas affected by natural disasters. So it's very rewarding and impactful that we can turn old blue jeans into denim insulation and then return it to the community.
Eric, is there any personal record for an individual who's dropped off some denim? What's the most pieces somebody has brought to you?
Oh, that's a great question. One year that just stands out for me, or like one drive, was our very first one in 2009, when I did when I was nine. And that was a very like basic year. I had a garage sale at my house way out in the farmlands. And basically we were just like, yeah, we put an ad in the newspaper and it landed on the local news and bring on all of your denim and anything like that. And this one guy showed up with a truckload of like 250 pairs of denim. And we were just absolutely blown away with the response that we got from the community. And I thought it was a really brilliant thing to do. And it's definitely something that helped factor into me wanting to run the project year after year.
So if somebody can't help you immediately, what can they do? When can they find you? Where can they find you? If they're like, I'm hearing this, I've got a closet full of old jeans I'm not going to wear, I want to get rid of them, make them something good, what can they do?
Yeah, definitely. I do have a website called gogreenohio.org. And that's updated continuously. And unfortunately, in the Cincinnati area, I'm going back home over the summer, but hopefully we can do more similar drives like this in the future. Anything helps. If it's one pair of jeans or 50, any small difference or any small amount makes a big difference in recycling.
We'll have links to Cotton Incorporated's Blue Jeans Go Green program and Eric Hansen's website as well at WVXU.org. Andrea Samber from Cotton Incorporated and Eric Hansen, a student at the University of Cincinnati who spends a lot of time collecting denim. Thank you both for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was University of Cincinnati student Eric Hansen and Blue Jeans Go Green founder and Cotton Incorporated director Andrea Samber talking with me earlier. I was told this morning that Eric collected another 440 pieces of denim in his drive at UC on Saturday. But it's not just old jeans in your closet that could find a new life through recycling. What about your old electronics? I spoke earlier with Frank Adams, the executive director of the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative, about how to do just that. Frank Adams is the executive director of the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative. And Frank, when one of your board members, Amy Vogelsang, wrote us an email about why we should talk to you all about Earth Day, I want to let you know that she said this email is being typed on just such a recycled computer whose useful life has been dramatically extended, much to the benefit of the community and the environment. So that's part of what you guys do, right? You take old computers and you either extend their lives or you find a way to recycle them.
That's correct. That's right.
How's that?
Businesses and individuals. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to ask, how does that work exactly? How does one recycle a computer?
Businesses and individuals donate their old computers to us. We refurbish the ones that we can and make them available to like the elderly or students or schools or orphanages, other nonprofits. And we sell them for very cheap. And the ones that we can't refurbish, then we recycle responsibly. We send them to downstream processors who are certified and, you know, make sure all the data is safe on their computers. Every bit of data that comes in the building doesn't leave.
And one of the areas that you focus on at the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative is helping out students. Tell us how you do that.
We have laptops and desktops that are refurbished. They have Windows 10 and Office 2010 on them. So it's $300 worth of software, and we make them available starting at $150 and going up from there.
So we're talking about computers, but what other types of electronic devices can people drop off?
Cell phones. Really, we just prefer computers and computer peripherals, monitors. CRT monitors are a bit of a problem because they're full of lead. But, you know, keyboards, mice. Servers, enterprise networking stuff, just about anything electronic.
And in the note that we received from your organization, it said every box of trash kept out of our landfills is a small win for the planet. Do you know offhand just how much trash you've kept out of landfills over the years?
More than 4 million pounds.
How do you calculate that?
We weigh everything that goes out and every other week, I'm taking about 10,000 pounds of stuff up to Cohen in Middletown to be recycled.
Okay, so you mentioned that some people will maybe try to bring computer monitors and those don't work for you. Are there any other no-nos about what not to bring?
Well, just CRT monitors, the old kind, and we will take them, but we ask for a $20 donation to offset disposal costs.
Yeah, so you guys are selling these refurbished computers at a pretty steep discounted rate. How do you guys stay afloat? How are you a sustainable operation?
It's all through sales. It's we're completely self-funding. We're mainly volunteer. We've got 4 employees now. And we managed to pay the rent and everything just through the sales out the door.
And
we also managed to give away a lot of computers, too. We've
given
over 1,000 away to area teachers for free in collaboration with Cranston Computers.
And so what's the process like when somebody shows up, you know, without knowing how it all works? They've got some old devices they'd like to hand off to you rather than throwing them in the garbage. What happens when they come in?
Well, okay, during volunteer hours, it's Wednesday evening 6 till 9, or Saturday morning 9 till noon. Basically, they just pull up. There's a crew of volunteers there to unload everything and inventory it and give them a receipt. And, they know their data's safe and they can be on their way.
Frank Adams is the executive director of the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative. Thanks so much for telling us your story today.
Okay. Hey, thanks very much.
Appreciate it, Frank. And that was Frank Adams, executive director of the Cincinnati Computer Cooperative, speaking with me earlier. Up next, the Kentucky Main Street Conference is in Covington this week. How that city and its neighbor, Bellevue, are utilizing creative tools to keep their business districts growing. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.